Chapter 33. Suave Broke. Schulich, capital Suave Broke province. Margol Suave Broke was the fourth of his family to be Hetman Suave Broke. His great-grandfather had taken on the Suave Broke last name after the existing Hetman died with no designated heir and no relative closer than third cousin. The struggle, and almost civil war, as to which family would fill the Hetman role, resulted in Margol's ancestor winning. However, the contentiousness of the succession still tainted elements within the Suave Broke clan, and Margol's grip on the leadership depended on a core of five Boyermen. The most important of these was Boyerman Hargo, whose district comprised the capital Schulich and the immediately surrounding area. The Suave Broke clan had suffered a single coastal raid by the Baldorians, but none yet from the Narthani. When reports came of raids and attacks on other clans, Hargo and two other Boyermen with coastal districts had resisted Margol's proposal to increase defenses and plan for evacuation in case of raids or invasions from the sea. As their overt position, they stated that the economic cost would be too great for events that might never occur. Margol Suave Broke knew they also had not agreed with his decision to come to Moreland's aid, being among the islanders who thought the Narthani threat too distant and that it involved other clans, not Suave Broke. The perceived victory at Moreland City had blunted the Boyerman's criticism of going to Moreland's aid. But Margol didn't feel his position was strong enough to fight the Boyerman's resistance to spending coin on improved defenses and evacuation planning in case of further Narthani attacks. Margol's eldest son, Harmon, openly expressed disdain for his father's lack of will in facing down the Boyerman. Margol passed off the clash to his son's youth and lack of experience about ruling the clan. His wife had arranged a family breakfast in hopes of preventing a further breach between father and son. She had counseled the latter to understand the demands of being the Hetman.
"Thank you for coming, Harmon, and I'm happy to see you, Marlena."
Harmon's wife was in the midterm of a third pregnancy. Both women wanted to prevent any larger rift, and had worked on their husbands.
"It's been too long, what with our hard heads arguing constantly," said Marlena. "I have Harmon's promise to be good for this morning. The same with his father."
Both men merely grunted, eyeing each other cautiously. The foursome sat, and servants brought in the morning meal. Hetman Suave Broke had just buttered a roll when his second son burst through the dining room door. Margol's wife frowned. She had left firm instructions the meal should be uninterrupted. Oblivious to her disfavor, her younger son addressed his father.
"The rider from the harbor, father. He says the sea is full of Narthani ships, and they're headed directly at Schulich."
Margol blanched. Harmon reddened, glared at his father, and was about to say something when his wife put a hand in his arm.
"Not now, Harmon. It's not the time."
Harmon took a deep breath and rose from his seat.
"Father, we need to get to the harbor immediately to see what's happening."
"Yes. Yes. Maybe the sighting is wrong, or the Narthani are just passing."
Harmon didn't counter. His expression conveyed his opinion. 15 minutes later, the Hetman and his son stood on a promontory overlooking the Schulich harbor. At sea, within 2 miles of the city, what appeared to the Suave Broke Hetman to be an endless number of Narthani ships under half sail pointed directly at the clan capital. Boyerman Hargo and Boyermen of the neighboring district stood flanking them. The three Boyermen had arrived shortly before Margol. Hargo from his residence and the other two Boyermen from where they stayed while visiting the city. The latter Boyermen had supported their Hetman's preparation proposals, and both had expressed dissatisfaction with their Hetman's unwillingness to confront Hargo, who now shifted uneasily on his feet, as if about to run. Margol remained calm. He had never been a decisive headman like his father and grandfather. When necessary, he made decisions, even if not timely ones or as firmly as he wished. He had told himself that times had been different when he became headman. While within himself, the truth always lurked below the surface. His uncertainties and feelings of inadequacy had caused his vacillations in the face of decisions. Until now, he saw only one path forward.
"Hetman," said one of the other boymen. "Alerts have gone out. Fighting men from all of Swaybrook will head this way as soon as they get the word and can get here. We'll do what we can to stop the Nathani at the shore, but you need to call on the other clans for help."
"No, sirs," replied Margol. "Look at the number of ships. The ocean floor is deep on this part of the coast. Their ships will come within 100 yards of the shore, or even right to the piers, and their cannon will control everything within range. The landmen, probably cannon, and even horses under the protection of the ships. We can't possibly gather enough men to stop them before they land. Any defense has to be out of ship cannon range. The most important thing is to save the people. Send word out immediately for everyone to head inland. Without a plan for how to get people out of the city, we'll have to do the best we can." Margol accompanied his last words with a dead-eye look at Boyerman Hargo, who stood stone-faced under the implied reprimand.
"Ring all abbey bells continuously," the hetman said to all of the men. "Spread word for people to gather only what they can carry. All other districts that can get men here should gather at St. Wilf's and help move the people and provide protection if the Nathani try to pursue us inland. I doubt that they brought enough horses to stop the evacuation, but they might harass and try to slow movement enough for their men on foot to catch up. Your men's task is to keep that from happening."
"But Shulik, father," said Harmon,
"where will we stand to defend the city, and with what men?"
Margol's calmness surprised him more than anyone else.
"If they learn the numbers of men and cannon, I suspect they will, there's nothing we can do to stop them from taking the city. Remember Moreland City, and what they did to the charge at their line."
"But we defeated them," argued Hargo.
"Josef Kolsko stated to us that the Nathani weren't defeated, they simply turned back. And although he didn't say it outright, I believe he wanted to caution us that only mistakes by Moreland and Iwill, and the Nathani being too confident, saved us. As chaotic as our defense is bound to be, do you really think we can stop thousands of Nathani?"
"But the city!" blurted a desperate Hargo. "We can't let them take the city! They could destroy it!"
"You should have thought of that before opposing plans for its defense," Margol hissed, all forbearance and deference to the city's boyerman gone.
"Time is wasting," said Margol. "Pass the word quickly to leave the city. If they're coming ashore, we don't have more than an hour before the first Nathani on Swaybrook land."
He turned to face Boyerman Hargo.
"Boyerman, gather all your district's fighting men in the city central square. By the time they gather, we'll know more than Nathani's exact intentions and then can plan to delay them long enough for most of the people to escape."
Hargo paled, but didn't give a rejoinder, only nodded and issued orders to his aides. The other two boymen left to help spread the evacuation order and send word to their own districts. Standing alone on the promontory, Margol put an arm on his son's shoulders.
"Harmon, ride back to the house and tell your brother to get the family inland. He's to stay with them and see your mother and sisters to safety. After you give him that word,
You go to St. Wilf's Abbey, east of the city, to the gathering place for fighting men from outlying villages and the other districts. You'll need to be in charge. But listen to the senior men and any boyarmen who get there. All of you are to help move people inland and protect them as best you can, if the Nathani come after them.
But father, said Harmon, his face showing distress, where will you be?
The son feared the answer.
I'll be with Boyarman Hargo, helping to slow the Nathani. I can't trust him to do what will be necessary, and there's no time to replace him without creating more chaos.
Margot placed his hands on his heir's shoulders.
It's also my penitence for not being a better hetman and having the strength to do what I believe needed doing. If the worst happens and I'm either dead or captured, you will be the hetman. If I'm dead, it will be clear. But if I'm their captive, we can't let them use me as a hostage. You are to consider me dead. In my office at home, in the lower desk drawer of my study, there's a sealed envelope. Inside is my declaration that in the eventuality of my incapacitation, you are to be considered the hetman. Use that as justification for assuming the hetman position. Enough of the boyarmen will support you to carry the argument. I've already discussed this with several of them, and with Hargo likely out of the picture. There shouldn't be serious protest.
Harmon didn't need elaboration to understand that Boyarman Hargo's absence meant his father would be dead or captured.
Harmon,
Margol choked out, pulling his son into a tight embrace.
We've had our disputes, but I want you to know I've never been disappointed in you, and anything that separated us has been more my fault than yours. You'll make a better hetman than me.
The hetman released his son and turned his back to face the harbor and the Nathani, as the closest ships started to furl sails.
Go now and save our clan.
Tears streaking Harmon's face, he mounted his horse and spurred toward the family home. Aboard Admiral Culkin's flagship.
Your first man should be ashore in a few minutes, Alpha,
said Morfred Culkin. Both men stood on the Admiral's flagship's forecastle, viewing the action. Four frigates had anchored just offshore and poured rounds and grapeshot into the neighborhoods bordering the harbor. Behind the frigates, troop carriers were a beehive of activity. The first longboats had neared the piers, and more were being unloaded, with men climbing down the sides of ships via rope netting. When the first men ashore secured the docks, more troop ships would tie directly to piers to unload. So far no sign of organized resistance, said Brigadier Ivag Zelfa. It's one of those things you don't know whether it's good or bad. Did we surprise them so much they haven't gotten themselves organized? Or do they have unpleasant surprises we haven't yet encountered? Culkin didn't answer for a moment, occupied with a word from his flag lieutenant, then turned back to Zalfa.
I don't envy your men ashore.
At least I see. You see the enemy clearly and see what's coming.
I'd rather be on ship.
Zalfa allowed himself a smile. But then the ground doesn't open up and swallow you if things go badly. Culkin laughed.
There is that. To each his own. I'll still stick with my ships. I'm also sure my captains will be glad to get rid of the horses. The smelly, stupid things have no business at sea. We're lucky it was a short trip, not like the ones from home. Only half of the horses survived those voyages.
Don't act too aggrieved for your sailors, and don't tell me they didn't enjoy the fresh meat.
Zalfa couldn't resist a small tease. I sometimes wonder whether some horses weren't helped along by sailors tired of salted meat and fish.
I'm shocked to hear you say such a thing, said Calkin,
and both men laughed. A last moment of humor before Zalfa left aboard a longboat. He would go ashore to direct the attack. He and General Akuyan had discussed and argued about who should command, Zalfa or one of the colonels, probably Ketton. Zalfa's point was that commanding the attack would take the three colonels away from their duties, while Zalfa had no direct day-to-day responsibilities once the attack force left aboard ship. Akuyan had reluctantly acceded to Zalfa's argument. A whistle from midship drew their attention. One of Zalfa's aides waved. It was time for the brigadier to head shore. Calkin drew closer.
Don't get yourself killed, Ivex.
Oaken might put that damn Erdlin in your place.
I can't stand that ass.
As a favor to you, Morfrid, Zalfa whispered back. I'll endeavor to stay alive. Although with 2,500 of our men around me, I think I'll be safe enough.
Nothing is safe when the action starts, whether on land or at sea.
So just stay out of the forefront. And let the junior officers take the risks. Nathani Headquarters, Pretty City. Sadak Izair walked up to Oaken Akuyan, who stood on the roof of the headquarters building, looking over the now almost empty harbor. Most of the warships that had been anchored in the harbor or just offshore were now at Swaybrook.
Can't get them off your mind, Oaken?
No, Sadak. I still have trouble seeing this many of my men off into action without me. And what happened last time doesn't help.
I wouldn't foresee anything going wrong, said Hizair. Well, at least not too wrong. The other clans won't have a chance to come to Swaybrook's aid before we reach our objectives. The men will burn Shulik to the ground and be gone within a couple of days, well before help arrives, if it does at all.
Intellectually, I know that, said Akuyan. Still, part of me can't help but wonder what can go wrong this time. And then there's the three strike teams. Whatever happened is over.
We won't know the results until the sloops return with the men we sent out.
Realistically, we can only hope half of them come back.
Hizair understood Akuyan's feelings, having many of the same in both this situation and many others he'd experienced.
It's part of reality, Oaken, as you well know. Men will be lost if we are to advance the Empire. All men like you and me can do is be sure any sacrifice we ask or danger we send men into is justified. In this case, we judge the strikes on the Hetman and on Swaybrook to be worth the risks, in order to tie down the clans until we get word back from Nothan.
Ordinarily, I'd agree with you, Sadak, but as you know, I've never been totally convinced that stirring up the clans like this is the best action.
Oh, I understand the reasoning, and it all sounds fine. But it still depends on the clans doing what we expect them to do. That didn't work out so well for us at Moreland City. Part of me wondered whether we might be better off ignoring the clans and hoping they sit back and do nothing. However, the other part of me worried about giving them time to gather themselves to attack us directly here. And the opinions of the rest of you finally swayed me to approve the attacks. I just hope we... I suppose I mean I made the right decision.
Semaphore Station, near Keelan-Moreland border. Amel Luton had managed the Semaphore Station ever since its construction. He knew how lucky he was to hold the position. Besides paying well, the station lay only 5 miles from his home in Amerth, the most northern settlement of Keelan province, large enough to be called a town, and the horseback ride let him enjoy time alone. Without being so long, as to take too much time from work or family. Normally, he enjoyed the work. He wouldn't admit, even to his wife, his voyeuristic attachment to reading other people's messages, and he made a great show of repeatedly reminding his three assistants to maintain the confidentiality of whatever information passed through their hands. The messages usually tended to contain topics of consequence, otherwise they wouldn't be sent over semaphore. Announcements of meetings such as conclaves, relatives informing of the death of a family member, petmen discussing issues from the mundane to the critical concerning Cadellium's future, and, only a few months ago, messages about the Narthani invasion of Moreland Province. However, the first message heading north from Kernford this morning had been a shock unlike any other he'd received. The Narthani had tried to assassinate Kalaj Keelan. The hetman had survived, but there had been deaths, though details weren't given in the alert sent out to all other clans. A message from Kernford had also alerted that a line south of the city was out of operation, and no messages could be passed on to Metak province until the line operated again. The message didn't mention the cause of the disruption, but Luton assumed it was related to the attack on the hetman. The station had just passed on the alert, along both lines heading northwest and northeast from Keelan. The northwest line went first to Moreland City, where it branched to Stent and Oros, and from there to northern clans. The northeast line went to Hewell, and from there toward the Adras, Powell, Bevins, and Nivax clans. Luton's assistants manned the panels. As soon as the alert message went out, the assistants used mounted telescopes to scan the northern adjacent stations for inbound messages. Only seconds had passed since the panels had been turned black to signal no more outgoing messages, when the assistant watching northwest shouted, "Incoming message!" Seconds later, the northeast assistant yelled, "One here too, just coming in!" It took time to read the panel settings via telescope on the adjacent station's panels and then acknowledge reception and response. Luton waited for the assistants to complete reception. 10 minutes passed. "Holy shit!" came an exclamation. Luton jumped out of his chair in the office and raced to the stairwell leading to the array sets on the roof. He had reached halfway upstairs when he heard another assistant shout in confusion, "What the hell is happening?"